All right, good morning. My name is Aaron Kohler. I teach here at in the university, in the Department of Jewish Studies. And what we'd like to do this morning is to look at our two major sources on the wars of the Hashmonaim to see how they describe who the good guys and the bad guys are. Our two major sources are the books of 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees, and I'll say a little bit about them in a second. The truth is we need two sorts of introductions before we can really get into the analysis. The first introduction is as to what really happened. So say something about that. We need that in order to then be able to judge, based on what really happened, how our sources describe what happened, so we can see what they're trying to do and how they're trying to spin the story. The other sort of introduction that we need is what these sources are, and we'll turn to that in a couple of minutes. So if you read the Hanukkah to-go packets over the last couple of years, I probably don't need to remind you as to what really happened in the story of Hanukkah. Last year, my teacher, Dr. Louis Feldman, who should live and be well, wrote a long paper in the Hanukkah to-go packet on what he called the Maccabean Revolt, the State of the Question. And this year, Dr. Lawrence Schiffman wrote a quick review called something like What Really Happened. Towards the back of the packet, and certainly you have it, so you can look at the details at some point. The Maccabean Revolt, What Really Happened, on page 41. That's a useful overview, useful review, and we'll come back to some of what they say later on. But I want to just give a sort of quick overview, quick reminder of some of the basic facts, so that we can talk intelligently about the sources. So the starting story with Antiochus' decree is very, very unfair. And that's something that emerges clearly from both Dr. Feldman's and Dr. Schiffman's presentations. That's really not the beginning of the story at all. It's got to start at least some years earlier than that. In, let's say, 175, when Antiochus IV comes to the throne. When he comes to the throne, a certain guy named Jason, a Kohen, goes to the new king, goes to Antiochus, and offers him a lot of money and says, I would like to be Kohen Gadol. Kohen Gadol was a position that had to be royally approved. So Antiochus says, great, we have a Kohen Gadol, he's a Kohen, he pays money, seems like a good guy. I looked into his eyes and saw that he was a quality human being. So he appoints Jason to be Kohen Gadol. Now, this provokes no protest, or at least we have no sources that there are any protests. So even though it seems to us a little bit upstanding that the position of the Kohen Gadol should be bought, no one seems to have reacted at all. Jason not only becomes Kohen Gadol, he turns Yerushalayim into a polis, meaning an official Hellenistic city. Now that comes with a lot of economic benefits. They can now participate in trade across the entire Hellenistic Empire. Lots of benefits that accrue to the city because they're a polis. So there are lots of good things about being a polis. And again, no one protests. What it does do, which again we might have thought was religiously problematic, was to separate essentially church and state. Until Jason did this, the official law of Yerushalayim was the Jewish law. And that had been a special right granted to Yerushalayim by an earlier king, by Seleucus. Who had officially given Yerushalayim the right to govern itself by its own laws. Jason, obviously with the support of Antiochus, takes that away and says, Jews can still be Jews. There's no problem with them being Jews, nothing impinging on their religion whatsoever, but the official state law is now general Hellenistic law. And so he's essentially separated church from state. And again, no protests. No one says anything about this. There are no mass uprisings. I assume that there was some grumbling in the street among some people. Probably not everyone liked what Jason was doing. But overall, it seems like the economic benefits and the political benefits of being a polis outweighed the inconvenience of not having the Torah law being the official state law now. And people went along with it. And so it was for a few years. In 171, so a few years later, 4 years later, Jason was beaten at his own game, essentially. Another guy, Menelaus, went to Antiochus and offered Antiochus even more money if he would be Kohen Gadol. Now, Menelaus has a long story about his political support, We're not even sure if he's a Kohen at all. One source talking about his brother says that his brother was from Shevet Binyamin. Now, if his brother's from Shevet Binyamin, it seems pretty clear that he can't be a Kohen at all. But it is only one source, and we're not totally sure. But he sort of outdoes Jason, and he becomes Kohen Gadol. Now, he's a much more radical figure than Jason was. And he doesn't just separate church from state. We're not totally sure what his original plan was, but we know that his appointment actually provoked massive protests in Yerushalayim. The Jews are really very upset about Menelaus. Maybe because he's not a Kohen, in which case the whole thing is corrupt. But also apparently because of his politics, he's aligned with a family we call the Tobiads, from a guy named Tuvia, who is a very rich, very wealthy guy from the other side of the Jordan River. And they're much more closely aligned with the Hellenists than Jason was. Now, it doesn't seem to be just a question of separating church from state. Here it really seems to be a question of pushing a pro-Hellenizing agenda against a Torah way of life. Here the Jews didn't take it lying down or sitting down. There are mass protests in the city. A delegation is sent to Antiochus, explaining what the problem was, saying, you got to take this guy back. He's no good. We can't tolerate him as Kohen Gadol. You've made a political mistake in nominating him and appointing him to be Kohen Gadol. But Antiochus doesn't listen. He overrules that delegation. And now tensions are simmering. The Jews are now not just upset about Menelaus. They're upset about Antiochus. They think he's doesn't get it. He's an obtuse ruler. He doesn't understand what it means to be a Jew. What's special about Yerushalayim? What's special about the Torah lifestyle? And tensions are really running very high. But they run high and they're simmering. They're sort of at a constant level for a few years. Fast forward another 3 years. 168, Antiochus, now forget his interaction with the Jews, for the second time he attacks Egypt. And this is long-running tensions between two Greek Hellenistic empires, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And he attacks Egypt, which is the Ptolemaic center, and he's really, really close to conquering Egypt. Another day, and he's got Egypt in his hand. Unfortunately for him, an ambassador from Rome shows up. Now, Rome at this point is sort of not on the world stage. No one's talking about Rome. No one's worried about Rome. But Rome is already has amassed a huge army, incredible riches. Everyone knows that it has incredible power, but it hasn't actually done anything militarily or politically yet in terms of expanding an empire. So Rome has always been on the margins, sort of not always the last couple of decades, not really being involved, but always being this wild card that one day they might get involved and that's going to really change everything. Now, they're not involved in the war, but the ambassador from Rome, a guy named Popilius, shows up just as Antiochus is about to engage in this final battle that's going to take Egypt for him, and he draws a circle around Antiochus in the sand. This might sound familiar from a much later story in the Gemara. Draws a circle around Antiochus in the sand and says, you may not leave the circle until you've declared loyalty to Rome and withdrawn your troops from Egypt. If you do, Rome's going to war against you. Now, Antiochus can't fight a war against Rome. He just doesn't have the power to do this. He knows this. He has no interest in fighting against Rome. Later on, Yehuda Maccabee actually has a treaty with Rome. Not clear that Rome actually sent soldiers, but everyone knows that Rome is the power to be reckoned with if they choose to get involved. And Antiochus can't deal with a war against Rome, and so really very, very embarrassingly has to declare his loyalty to Rome and pull out of Egypt right when he was on the cusp of victory rather than fight against Rome. And that's obviously a horribly degrading episode for him. While this happens, this is in 168, while this is happening in Egypt, rumors start swirling in Yerushalayim that Antiochus is actually dead. We have no understanding of how this happened. We don't know what the dynamics were. But somehow rumors start swirling that Antiochus is dead. It's not a crazy rumor. He just has been thoroughly embarrassed. But Jason, the exiled high priest, who used to be the high priest but lost his job, feels empowered by this. He's apparently been alive and well in what's now Jordan, on the other side of the Jordan River. And he gathers a few thousand troops, mercenaries presumably, and goes and attacks Yerushalayim, hoping to drive out Menelaus, who, remember, had been there only because of the support of Antiochus. If Antiochus is dead, Jason's obviously hoping that the people will turn on Menelaus, they'll throw out Menelaus, kick him out, and Jason will again be able to be the Kohen Gadol. Somehow it doesn't work out quite so well. Jason actually doesn't win. And even worse, Antiochus, who is of course not dead, starts hearing that there's a big revolt going on in Yerushalayim, that they're revolting against his rule, which is not entirely untrue, but it's obviously a series of miscommunications and sort of bad information that's circulating. And Antiochus gets really furious, so he's just had to suffer this terrible disgrace at the hands of the Romans. He was about to win, now he's walking out, the laughing stock of everyone. And now, right nearby in Yerushalayim, his territory is revolting against him, so he's really not in a very good mood. And we're told that he comes to Yerushalayim and he personally leads a massacre, slaughtering people. Thousands of people in Yerushalayim are killed, women, children, not just soldiers. Really terrible, terrible episode. At that point, the war is on. So now the Jews, of course, start resisting Antiochus openly. Now, they never liked him. They've always been opposed to him. There's sort of been this simmering tension. But now it's not simmering. Now it's erupted. And you get militant resistance to Antiochus. It's led at first sporadically by people, this group called the Hasidim. The Hasidim, we have them in the Greek text, the Asidaioi, but clearly the Hasidim. Not quite clear who they were, if they were a real group or just sort of like a term given to people who took their religion seriously. And it's not clear whether they had a real political structure or just they were anyone who took a hard line, we now call a Hasid, the pious people. And Antiochus reacts to this new uprising very heavy-handedly. Now come the famous decrees. Now comes outlawing Jewish religion. Now comes outlawing keeping kosher and Brit Milah and so on and so forth. That's certainly at the beginning of the story. It's not quite the end of the story either. Now you get the big wars. The resistance eventually coalesces around Matityahu of Modi'in, who might have just left Yerushalayim in 168 among all this tension, this uprising. He and his sons, and obviously the wars go on in what's the sort of well-known way. By 166, by the end of 166, just a couple of years later, when Matityahu dies, the Hashmonaim and their army has actually taken over all of Yehuda, all of Judea, the whole province, not very big, but that's what they have. They took over the province of Judea. And of course, by 164, Yehuda Maccabee has retaken Yerushalayim and rededicated the Beit HaMikdash, and Chafei of that year has Hanukkah. That's also not the end of the story. Really, the story has to go on at least for another decade or so, until about 152. So you have the first Hashmonai, who's actually appointed Kohen Gadol by the Hellenistic king. That makes it official that the Jews have won. They've reinstituted an autonomous Jewish state. And of course, the Hashmoneim dynasty goes on for a century, until 63. That the Rambam talks about at the beginning of Hilchot Chanukah, as sort of extraordinary passage in the Mishnah Torah, where he talks about Hanukkah as being the holiday of recapturing Jewish political autonomy, the only time during Bayit Sheni that we ever had that. All right, so that's sort of a bridge version of the course of events as it more or less unfolded. Second introduction, the sources that we have. So one Maccabees and two Maccabees. So these two books, and ideally the source sheets actually would have just been copies of these books. They're very easily accessible. The easiest way to get them is to go online and type in like one Maccabees, and you get the full text of one Maccabees, or two Maccabees, you get the full text of two Maccabees. But they're in the Apocrypha, which means that 500-600 years ago they would have been in the Christian Bible. Martin Luther took them out because they're not in the Jewish Bible, and Luther thought that anything that wasn't in the Jewish Bible probably didn't belong in the Christian Bible either. They're still in the Catholic Bible, you can buy them in Barnes & Noble. You're looking for the collection called the Apocrypha, and these are our two sources for the Wars of the Hashmoneim. Now these are intensely Jewish books. We'll talk about how intensely over the next few minutes, but these are Jewish books, meaning they're written by Jews, about Jews, for Jewish reasons, for Jewish audience. We have them both only in Greek. They're totally different books. It's not like Malachim Aleph and Malachim Bet, which is the same book, just cut in half. One Maccabees and two Maccabees are actually different books, and that's what we're going to talk about, the different perspectives that the books have. One Maccabee is something like a court history of the Hashmonaim. It covers the period from about 175, from Antiochus when he becomes a king, till 134, when Yochanan Hyrcanus becomes the Kohen Gadol and the leader of the Jews. He's already a second generation, third Hashmonaim leader to be the leader of the Jews. And it tells the story of the wars and the politics. It's a really wonderful and very important source. 2 Maccabees, different book, tells us that it's actually a summary of an older 5-volume book, basically telling about the story of Yehuda Maccabee only. It ends in 161, when Yehuda Maccabee is still alive, with Yehuda's famous battle against Nicanor, which actually created a holiday, Yom Nicanor, which is still mentioned in Megillas Tainis. This 5-volume book written by someone named Jason of Cyrene, the city in Libya, in North Africa. Jason apparently wrote a 5-volume history of Yehuda Maccabee's wars. We don't have that 5-volume history. What we have is this summary, which we have in the one book, about 15 chapters, which we know is 2 Maccabees. So we have these two different sources. One's more narrowly focused on those first few years. The other one is sort of a more sprawling history of 40 years of the story. And what we're going to talk about now is how they have different perspectives also on the political events. We have them both only in Greek. Well, we have them in English also, but that's not original. We have them in a lot of languages, I guess. But the original text we have only in Greek. We don't know what language they were originally written in. The 1 Maccabees, we assume, was written originally in Greek. 2 Maccabees, that 5-volume book, may well not have been written in Greek, although we don't know. 2 Maccabees itself was apparently written in Greek originally. It's hard to say what the original language is. The reason we have them only in Greek, if there was a Hebrew or Aramaic original, is because the Jews didn't preserve these books. For reasons that are complicated, but very interesting, Jews stopped reading these books. Jews also stopped reading Josephus, which would be our other major source for the time period. Josephus actually is, the reason I'm not talking about him is because he basically just copies over 1 Maccabees. So he's not an independent source. He simply uses 1 Maccabees and incorporates that story into his history. But Jews stopped reading all these books for about 1,500 years. From about Churban HaBayit, maybe a little later, from Tkufat Chazal, till about the Renaissance when Jews started rediscovering them. But that means that if there were any Hebrew or Aramaic originals of them, they were lost. These books were preserved only by the Christians. They were preserved by the Christians in these cases because they were actually biblical books. They were in the Christian Bible. We can be thankful for that. Meaning these are actually Jewish books preserved by the Christians for their own reasons, but we're sort of happy to take them back. Certainly happy to have access for them. All right. So we're going to start a little bit with 1 Maccabees. You have a bunch of sources in front of you, and sorry. Let me just make sure I have the same handout that you have. So in the story told by 1 Maccabees, which seems to be something of a court history of the Hashmonaim, it's unambiguously clear that Gentiles are evil. Let's just take it for granted. It needs almost no explanation, no justification. Jews are good, non-Jews are bad. The only exceptions to that are when Jews act like non-Jews. If Jews act like non-Jews, then they're obviously by definition evil also. So one example of that from chapter 5 in 1 Maccabees, when the Gentiles all around, this is the first source you have on page 1, when the Gentiles all around heard that the altar had been rebuilt and the sanctuary dedicated as it was before, they became very angry. They determined to destroy the descendants of Jacob who lived among them. So they began to kill and destroy among the people. In other words, this needs no justification. The Jews are there. The Jews build a mizbeach. Obviously, the non-Jews attack them. This seems like obvious, right? It's just an intransigent animosity between Jews and Gentiles. If the Jews are going to be there, the Gentiles are going to attack. This is simply the way of the world. The author feels no need to explain why this might have happened, what provoked them. It's just taken for granted. The Jews build a mizbeach, and so the Gentiles attack them. In another another text later on, one of the Hashmonaim's brothers, Shimon, who's the leader after the deaths of Yehuda and then Yonatan, gives a rousing speech to his comrades in arm, preparing for battle. And you have this in the second source in chapter 13. Shimon heard that Trepho had assembled a large army to invade the land of Judah and destroy it, and he saw that the people were trembling with fear. So he went up to Jerusalem, gathering the people. He encouraged them and said, this is his speech, "You yourselves know what great things my brothers and I and the house of my father have done for the laws and the sanctuary. You know also the wars and the difficulties that my brothers and I have seen. By reason of this, all my brothers have perished for the sake of Israel, and I alone am left. And now, far be it from me to spare my life in any times of distress, for I'm not better than my brothers, but I will avenge my nation and the sanctuary and your wives and children, for all the nations have gathered together out of hatred to destroy us." I said, why is there a war? So it's simple why there's a war. Because we're Jews, and they're Gentiles, so they hate us. So what do we have to do? There's only one course of action open to us. Pick up our swords and fight. And that's all we can do. This is simply the way of the world. Jews are hated by Gentiles, and so Jews have only two options. They can die, or they can fight. Shimon says, well, I'm not going to die. I'm no better than my brothers. My brothers went down fighting. I'm going to go down fighting as well. But this is simply taken for granted. The Gentiles hate us. They're gathered around out of hatred to destroy us, and so we have to fight. Nothing in the Jewish behavior is ever said to justify this, right? It doesn't say anything about the fact that that Jews actually, you know, were the first ones to pick up arms in the battle, that it was actually an inter-Jewish war that came first, that Jason and Menelaus were fighting before the Greeks ever got involved. That's way too complicated for the world view here, right? We have Gentiles, we have Jews, Gentiles hate Jews, Jews have to fight against Gentiles, that's all there is to it. Nothing else has to be said. By the same token, Jews don't need any excuse to attack Gentiles. This is actually interesting. Not as opposed to what we just said, but this is even more interesting. The Jews, it's taken for granted that if the Gentiles are around, Jews should attack them. Certainly if there's any need that they have, if the Hashmoneim need to expand their territory or need to win, they find themselves next to Gentiles, so it just seems natural that Jews should attack Gentiles, the same way it seems natural that Gentiles should attack Jews. And again, this seems to not need any explanation, but this is only in 1 Maccabees, and that's why we'll use this as a point of contrast. In 2 Maccabees, a lot of space is actually dedicated to explaining if there is a conflict, why there's a conflict, what went wrong to create this conflict. But in 1 Maccabees, it's simply taken for granted that the Jews and the Gentiles are going to be at war. So you have at the bottom of the first page, 2 accounts of one battle. It's the same war, where Yehuda Maccabee attacks an army under Timothy, this guy, Timotheus. So in 1 Maccabees, it's stated very straightforwardly. Then he crossed over to attack the Ammonites, where he found a strong band of many people, with Timothy as their leader. He engaged in many battles with them, and they were crushed before him. He struck them down. Why? Nothing need be said about that. They simply take it for granted. Yehuda Maccabee, there are Gentiles on the other side of the river. He goes and attacks them. That's the way that this conflict goes. In 2 Maccabees, though, I mean, you can tell just from the length of the passage, but it's much more complicated. 2 Maccabees says something very different. Now, Timothy, who had been defeated by the Jews before, gathered a tremendous force of mercenaries and collected the cavalry from Asia in no small number. As he drew near, Maccabeus and his men sprinkled dust on their heads and girded their loins with sackcloth in supplication to God. When they came near the enemy, they halted. So Judah's not going to just rush into battle to attack the enemy. He stops. As dawn was breaking, the two armies joined battle, the one having as pledge of success and victory not only their valor, but also their reliance on the Lord, while the other made rage their leader in the fight. When the battle became fierce, there appeared to the enemy from heaven 5 resplendent men on horses with golden bridles, and they were leading the Jews. They killed Timothy, and when they accomplished these great things with hymns and thanksgivings, they blessed the Lord, who shows great kindness to Israel and gives them the victory. So here we have a much more complicated story. First of all, Timothy he's not just sitting there waiting to be attacked by Yehuda Maccabee. As 1 Maccabee says, he's there, so Yehuda Maccabee attacks. He's the one who starts. He gathers massive numbers of mercenary and cavalry, and he's joining battle. He also, in a passage in this chapter in some of the psukim that I skipped, he blasphemes God. He challenges the Lord of Israel. He says, there's no way that you can win. I am stronger than God. So now it's not just a question of a Gentile. It's a question of a blaspheming Gentile. This is wholly different. Timothy, of course, is why is he motivated to fight against Yehuda Maccabee? Not because he's a Gentile, but you had that first pasuk, because he's lost earlier. So he's mad. He's raging. This is a much more human portrait of someone. And the battle is not there because there's entrenched animosity between the Jews and their non-Jewish enemies, but because there's a complicated story to be told about this particular general and his personal history and his behavior in this particular battle. And in fact, we're told in 2 Maccabees, but not in 1 Maccabees, that Hashem is on the side of the Maccabim. Right? These five resplendent men come down from heaven to fight on the Jew's side. That's a sure sign from heaven that God's supporting the Hashmonaim. 1 Maccabees, there's no signs from heaven. It's simply take it for granted. It's a much more black and white world. You don't need signs from heaven that the Jews are doing the right thing. The Jews are almost by definition doing the right thing. If they're Jews fighting non-Jews, obviously the Jews are the side of good. In 2 Maccabees, it's not that simple. And so we need to prove that in fact this battle was legitimate. In fact, this battle was justified. How do you prove it? Well, first of all, you justify it. You tell what they've done wrong. And second of all, you show that Hashem said so. Hashem sent messengers in the middle to fight on Yehuda's side. Well, then obviously God has given his seal of approval here. He's given his gushpanka. Said, yeah, this is a battle that I'm taking part in. Those people really deserve to lose this battle. But again, that's a big difference between the two books. Well, what kind of book is 2 Maccabees then? We've talked a little bit about 1 Maccabees. What kind of book is 2 Maccabees? So as we'll see developing, 2 Maccabees is very much a diaspora book. I already mentioned that it was written by someone who lived in Cyrene in Libya. I guess that sounds funny today, to have a important Jewish historian living in Libya. But it was actually written first by someone from Libya. And we have good reason to think that the epitomizer, the summarizer, the one who actually gave us the book of 2 Maccabees as we have it, is also a diaspora Jew, probably from Alexandria. What do we know about Alexandria, northern Egypt? At least 100 years later, 200 years later, it's a Jewish community of 1 million Jews living in Alexandria, who are intensely loyal to Judaism, to the Torah, even to Yerushalayim, but don't, at least most of them, don't speak Hebrew. They don't know Hebrew. So their politics are a little bit complicated. And of course, what's sort of so obvious that it almost doesn't need to be said is that they're not living in a Jewish state. They're living in Ptolemaic Alexandria. So they don't have a lot of sympathy for the Seleucids, they don't have a lot of sympathy for Antiochus, but they also don't have a lot of sympathy for people who advocate independence at all costs, because that's not their life. It's not a life that they can afford to fight for, or even that they want to be seen espousing. Can you imagine if the 1 million Jews in Alexandria got up and said, obviously, ideally, what Jews would be doing would be overthrowing the empire. Unfortunately, we're not strong enough to do that. Well, that's terrible politics. It's a terrible idea if you live as a minority in a foreign empire to go around talking about how much you wish you could overthrow that foreign empire. So the idea of sort of championing Yehuda Maccabee, well, he's a hero. There's a lot to be said for him. But we understand this is going to be complicated. It's going to be nuanced. They're going to have to sort of think through at every turn. How exactly are we going to formulate what it is that we like about Yehuda Maccabee? What exactly is it that we're championing here? The idea of independence at all costs is not something that the author of 2 Maccabees can afford to champion. And we'll see that developing over the next few sources. 1 Maccabees, on the other hand, is troubled by none of that. 1 Maccabees is written by someone apparently in Yehuda, probably in Yerushalayim, under the Hashmonaim, when the Hashmonaim are already independent, and they have the opposite perspective, the opposite need. What they want to emphasize is why the Hashmonaim had to fight these wars. Because, we'll talk again in a few minutes, not all Jews thought this was the most important thing in the world. After all, at least until it became an open battle, you could have lived as a Torah Jew under the Hellenistic Empire. You didn't have to fight for independence. And there was a point in 164, before Hanukkah happened, that Antiochus actually said, amnesty program. Everyone put down your arms, everyone sign a peace treaty, we can go back to the original plan where you can live as Jews, I'm rescinding all of my decrees, everyone could be live happily as Jews in Yerushalayim, in Yehuda. No independence, no political independence, but I'll get rid of Menelaus, I'll get rid of the things that you really hated, certainly get rid of the Gzerot, and we'll go back to what we had 5 years ago, 6 years ago. There was an equilibrium that we can return to. And at that point, we're told in the books of in the book of 1 Maccabees that much of Yehuda Maccabees' army put down their swords. In particular, the Hasidim, the people who were really motivated by the religious impositions, by the Gzerot, who said, hey, we can't live like this. We have to fight for our religion. At this point, they say, okay, battle's over. That was our goal. Our goal was religious independence. Our goal was religious autonomy. We could do what we want. We have it. The war is over. We don't need to fight anymore. We don't need to suffer any more casualties. We don't need to go on fighting. We can go back to our normal lives and return to just being Jews in the Seleucid Empire. Wouldn't that be great? And half of Yehuda Maccabee's army leaves. Yehuda refuses, though. He's clearly gotten it into his head that he's not just fighting for religious independence anymore. He's fighting for political independence. But not everyone agreed. And so 20, 30 years later, the author of 1 Maccabees doesn't just have to say that the Hashmoneim were successful. That everyone knows. The question is, though, what was it worthwhile? We have independence, but we gave up a lot. We had a decade, 15 years of hard war. We had thousands and thousands of casualties after we didn't need casualties, after we could have just had a peace accord and we could have gone back to living peaceably under the Seleucids. We could have been a polis. Remember, that came with a lot of economic benefits. We're no longer a polis. Now we're detached from the rest of the Seleucid Empire. So we lost a lot in continuing to fight for independence. Was that really worthwhile? And the author of 1 Maccabees, almost exactly the opposite direction of the author of 2 Maccabees, has to argue that absolutely it was worthwhile. That this war was not only important, but it was the only way we could have survived. That this sort of this idea of living in an equilibrium, living as Jews under the Seleucid Empire, is never going to work. Because there are intractable problems between the Jews and the Seleucids, intractable problems between the Jews and the Hellenists that would have led to conflict all the time. So what's one way of doing that? Claiming that Jews and Gentiles cannot, by their very nature, get along. As Jews and Gentiles are inherently enemies. There's inherent animosity between these two sides. So the author of 1 Maccabees wants to spin this story to emphasize just how deep this animosity was. The author of 2 Maccabees wants to spin the story to show that there's really no animosity whatsoever. So we have our two very different perspectives on the same events, going to tell some of the same stories, but try to see very different lessons and morals in these two stories. So let's go on to a couple more examples. you turn the page in the source sheet. Why are we fighting? What's the reason for fighting? So we just said, that's actually a key question. Why are we fighting? What's the point of this? So according to 1 Maccabees, because the threat to the Jews is just inherent in the nature of Jews and Gentiles, the worst thing you can imagine would be that the lines between these two camps would blur. In other words, that the Gentiles would start acting like Jews. There is a book that talks about that, right? Which book has that as sort of the climax of the book? Esther, right? Right? The Gentiles start acting like Jews. So for 1 Maccabees, that's horrible. This is like the world coming to an end. I mean, you have these two entrenched parties. If the lines start to blur, then things are really falling apart. And even worse, of course, than Gentiles acting like Jews, which at least we could tolerate because the good guys are adding to their side, would be Jews acting like Gentiles. How could Jews act like Gentiles? Well, the most obvious way is the physical way. If they don't circumcise their sons, they're looking and acting like Gentiles. And so in 1 Maccabees, the idea of the lack of circumcision, this is deeply symbolic. This means that the Jews are looking and acting like Gentiles. But before that, one case in chapter 5 in 1 Maccabees. The people of Gilad, in other words, again, on the other side of the Jordan, but now farther up north, write to Yehuda, asking him for help. And they say, you have this in verse 10, skipped around a bit, but verse 10, the Gentiles around us have gathered together to destroy us. So indeed, Shimon went to the Galilee and fought many battles against the Gentiles, and the Gentiles were crushed before them. He pursued them to the gate of Ptolemais. As many as 3,000 of the Gentiles fell, and he despoiled them. Then he took the Jews of Galilee and Arbata with their wives and children and all they possessed, and led them to Judea with great rejoicing. In other words, the climax of the victory is that the Jews are saved from being surrounded by the Gentiles. Right? We no longer have to worry about this mixing of the nations. That the Jews were up there, and then the Gentiles are around them. Don't worry, we consolidate the Jews. What's the sort of end game of this, if this continues? Is that the Jews will all live in one enclave. Right? All the Jews will be in Yerushalayim and Yehuda. And the Gentiles will leave down the rest of the territory. And so this is a sort of a happy ending. So the Jews and the Gentiles are getting physically separated. Example by example, step by step, the Jews and the Gentiles are actually being taken apart physically, separated from each other. Now in chapter 2 in 1 Maccabees, after Matityahu picks up his sword and starts fighting, we have this very, difficult, challenging, interesting passage. Matityahu and his friends went around and tore down the altars. They forcibly circumcised all the uncircumcised boys that they found within the borders of Israel. They hunted down the arrogant, and the work prospered in their hands. Now, forcible circumcision. You would think that they don't need to forcibly circumcise. You would think, all circumcision is forcible, but you would think that they don't need to do that. All they have to do is say that it's no longer usher to circumcise, right? It's no longer forbidden, and now all the parents are going to get up and say, like, oh, it's been torturous, you know, having a child has been already a year old, 2 years old, they haven't been able to have a bris milah. So finally I can have a bris milah. That's apparently not what's going on. Matityahu insists, not just on removing the prohibition, the iser on circumcision, but actually going around and forcibly circumcising everyone. Now that might be really interesting in terms of revealing what many of the people actually were doing, or were at least willing to do. It's also interesting because Matityahu was not willing to leave it up to the people. In other words, if the parents said, we're actually fine, we've lived for a year with our son non-circumcised, and it turns out that we're not racked with guilt as we thought we might be, so we're just going to continue this way. Matityahu was not willing to leave it that way and say, well, it's up to you, you know. I just wanted to make sure there was freedom of religion in the country. Now it's up to you. No, he's going to forcibly circumcise the children. Why is this such an issue for him? He's presumably, at least we're not told, that he's going around forcing people to give up their pigs or forcing people to keep Shabbat. Circumcision in particular seems to have been an issue because that's the most obvious marker of what separates the Jews from the Gentiles. And the idea of having Jews who look like Gentiles, who are acting like Gentiles, that was really the one line that Matityahu and his sons couldn't tolerate being crossed. So it's not enough to just say, it's up to you. It's not up to you. Here's the key point. If we're going to have a worldview in which Jews are separated from Gentiles, as black is separated from white, then we need to make sure that line is really clear. If that line is porous and some Jews are not circumcised and some Gentiles are acting like Jews and so on, that's not a world we can accept. We have to make sure that we've gone and forced the Jews to toe that line, force the Jews to really make a hard line, say Jews circumcise, non-Jews don't circumcise, and never the twain shall meet. Now, not all of the Jews, as we've already mentioned, seem to have shared the Hashmonaim's political views. Lots of the Jews, it seems like a vast majority of the Jews, did share the antipathy of the Hashmonaim towards the Seleucid involvement in Jewish religion. That seems clear. It's not a fringe group that thought it was unacceptable for the government to say that we couldn't keep Shabbat and couldn't keep Kashrut. That seems to have been widespread. But even among the Jews who didn't, who opposed the Seleucids, there seem to have been different views as to how to deal with this. And as we said, the Hashmonaim were the most militant among them. We have a few sources of people who simply just, they opposed it, but they didn't think that picking up the sword was the right way to go. So at the end of the first chapter in 1 Maccabees, which is a very long chapter, but at the end of the first chapter, right in the middle of page 2, we have these two lines. But many in Israel stood firm and were resolved in their hearts not to eat unclean food. They chose to die rather than being defiled by food or to profane the holy covenant, and they did die. Very great wrath came upon Israel. I actually don't know what that means. I mean, it's unclear what that means. Very great wrath came upon Israel, meaning within from the people. Does that mean that God was provoked by the martyrs? Does it mean that God was annoyed at what the martyrs were doing? It's unclear from the context what this very great wrath was and what it accomplished. What it leads into is the very next pasuk, which is the beginning of Perek Bet in 1 Maccabees. In those days, Matityahu, son of Yochanan, son of Shimon, a priest of the family of Yoariv, moved from Jerusalem and settled in Modiin, and so on, and he says, even if all the nations that live under the rule of the king obey him, blah, 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 I and my sons and my brothers will continue to live by the covenants of our ancestors. We will not obey the king's words by turning aside from our religion to the right hand or to the left. Now, of course, what makes Matityahu and his sons different from the martyrs mentioned at the end of Perek Aleph is not in their attitude towards violating the mitzvot. Both of them agree they're not going to violate the mitzvot. The difference comes in what's about to happen. Because Matityahu says, I'm not going to violate the mitzvot, but I'm also not going to stand around and let you kill me. I'm going to pick up my sword and I'm going to fight with you. Now, what's the worst that can happen if I fight with you? I die. If I don't fight with you, well, then I definitely die. Okay? So, I'd rather go down fighting. Now, why didn't the martyrs think of that? The answer is that the martyrs did think of that. But they had no interest in fighting a big war. What's their political view here is that they shouldn't pick up a sword. That they should be passive. What's the point of being passive, though? What do you gain from being passive? I mean, you're just gonna keep dying, and I'm going to die, and you're going to die, and she's going to die, and they're going to die, and now we're going to have no one left. So that's obviously bad politics. Doesn't make any sense. So what's the goal here? The goal is actually illuminated by another source that seems to have disagreed with the Hashmonaim, Daniel Yud-Aleph. The author of Daniel Yud-Aleph, who's sort of explicitly talking about the time of the Hashmonaim, says, Uva uvo tziyim kitim, ships of the western coastlands will oppose him, he'll lose heart. Then he'll turn back and vent his fury against the Brit Kodesh. So this is talking about the evil king. The wicked king is going to attack, and then ships of the western coastlands will oppose him, and he'll turn back and vent his fury against the Brit Kodesh. What's that referring to? Seems entirely transparent, right? This is a reference to Antiochus losing in Egypt and then coming back and venting his fury against Yerushalayim in 168, like we talked about earlier. The ships of the western coastline, that's Rome, who showed up to drive them out of Egypt. And Antiochus turns around, and since he can't beat Rome, he vents his fury on Yerushalayim, on the Brit Kodesh. But then listen to what the author of Daniel Yud-Aleph says. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress, will abolish the daily sacrifice. That only happened once in all of Vayicheni history. That's under Antiochus. Then they'll set up the abomination that causes desolation. Again, this is transparently a reference to Antiochus. You don't have to think very hard to match this up with the real events. Umar she'ev rit yachanif b'chalakot. With flattery, he'll corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. Ye'azru ezer me'at, v'nilvu alehem rabim b'chalak lakot. When they fall, sorry, I have to actually turn the page for the English, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. U'mina maskilim mikashlu l'trof b'hem l'varer l'abein ad eit kates ki od l'amoed. And some of the wise will stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. Okay, so we have two things that are really interesting here. One is that Pasuk Lam and Dalad seems to clearly be a reference to the Hashmoneim. That they're going to get an Ezer Me'at. Uvihi Kashlam Ye'ezru Ezer Me'at. As they fall, they'll receive a little help. A little help. Now, they're falling. Who's the people who are falling? This is obviously not the Hashmonaim, right? These are the people who are opting to martyr themselves. They're choosing not to fight. They're choosing not to violate the mitzvot either. They're saying, look, we're not going to fight. We're willing to fall. We're willing to fall by the Cherev, by the Lahava, by Shvi, by Viza. It's a bad time. There's going to be lots of casualties, lots of catastrophes, but that's what there is. And as they fall, they'll receive a little bit of help. That little bit of help is presumably the Hashmonaim who are going to help up, who are going to get up and actually fight for them. But at least according to the author of Daniel, it's not going to be a lot of help. It's going to be an Ezer Me'at. He doesn't seem to be too optimistic about the possibility of militant resistance. Well, how is there going to be a happy ending then? And Lamed Hey tells us the happy ending. What's the happy ending? The happy ending is, Ad eight kates, ki od lamoed, until the time of the end. For it will still come at the appointed time. In other words, the people who are martyring themselves, they don't think the Seleucids are going to win. They think that this is all God's plan, and there's a particular time at which God's going to say, enough. That the oppression, the tragedies, can go on for a certain amount of time. And of course, in Daniel, you get real calculations as to how long exactly this is going to happen. 490 years, 77s, and then broken down into 352 years, and a time, a time, a time and a half, and all sorts of different calculations that Daniel is playing with, whatever they mean, he really thinks that there's a determined time at which the oppression is going to end. So what's the logic behind martyring yourself? It's not that I think that somehow this is going to lead naturally to a happy ending. It's that it doesn't matter what I do. Whether I die or not die, there's a certain time, and obviously I hope it's very, very soon, when God has slated this oppression to come to an end. When God has said, these tzarot are going to come to an end. So, there's not much point in me resisting. There's no point in me picking up a sword. That can only be an ezer ma'at. That can only be a little bit of a help. What do I gain? So I kill, you know, three Seleucids on my way down. Then I'm going to die, and then what happens? Nothing. Because I'm not going to win before God has appointed the time anyway. Until that appointed moed, that's when the Jews are going to come back and be victorious. Nothing else is going to happen until then. No big event. So I just have a choice. I can either be over on the mitzvot until then, and then, you know, go to hell eventually. Or I can not be over on the mitzvot, martyr myself, and nationally, politically, the ending of the story is going to be the same anyway. There's going to be a certain time at which God says, now comes the end time. Now comes the case. Now comes the moed, at which I'm going to reinstitute Jewish victory over the forces of evil in the world. Now, what's the Hashmonaim's perspective on these kinds of people? This is terrible. The Hashmonaim have no patience for this kind of politics. This politics of sitting around and sort of like waiting for the end time, waiting for God to do something. The Hashmonaim have almost exactly the opposite perspective. Nothing's going to happen unless I pick up a sword. If I don't do anything, then nothing will ever come of this. The Seleucids will just be allowed to run rampant. And there'll be eternal Seleucid rule over Yerushalayim, eternal Seleucid rule over the Beit HaMikdash, and we'll never recover anything, we'll never reinstate anything. Now, am I guaranteed victory? No! But that's okay. That's okay. I'm willing to go down fighting. Nothing's guaranteed. This is the exact opposite of the author of Daniel Yud Aleph, of apparently the martyrs that 1 Maccabees talks about, who said, we're just going to martyr ourselves, and that's it. But Matityahu, he got up and said, there's actually work to be done. In other words, 1 Maccabees acknowledges that there were martyrs, but doesn't have a lot of respect for them as actually part of the resistance movement. They're basically, cold-hearted about it, selfish and useless in the scheme of things. Because they've chosen a sort of religiously glorious death. They've gotten their share in Olam Haba, but they've accomplished nothing on behalf of anyone else. We, the rest of us, are still in exactly the same dire straits that we were ever in. Matityahu says, look, I'm not afraid of death. I'm okay with dying. That's not why I don't like martyrdom. I'm fine with dying. What I don't like is the idea of going down without contributing to the national cause. So I'm going to pick up my sword. I'm going to teach my sons to pick up their sword. And we read Shimon's speech in chapter 13, where he says, I'm no better than my brothers. My brothers went down fighting, and I'm prepared to go down fighting as well. That's a very different kind of martyrdom. That's giving yourself with the sense that no matter what happens to me, I furthered the cause. An individual martyr, at least according to the Hashmonaim, is not furthering any cause. They're simply dying, exiting stage left, and leaving the show to go on as if nothing's ever changed. Now, the author of Daniel, at least Daniel Yud Aleph, has a different view. He says, you're exiting stage left, but Chashmoneim, you are also. No one can do anything. It's not that the martyrs are not doing anything, but you are doing something. No one can do anything. You just have to wait for God. God will eventually change the course of events. He'll eventually make the Jews come back on top and make the Jews victorious. But he opposes the Chashmoneim for a different reason. They're nezer ma'at. They're doing a little bit. Maybe helping, you know, ease a little bit in the meantime. But they're not fundamentally changing anything. They're not accomplishing anything in the big picture. In the scheme of things, the only figure who can actually do anything is God himself. Now, that's all, of course, one Maccabees. Before I turn to two Maccabees, let me just mention one more passage from one Maccabees. Did I include this? It's the next one on the top of page 3. It's from the continuation of Perek Bet in one Maccabees. And just to further this point, Matityahu, not only does he not think that going down peacefully is worthwhile, he doesn't think that going down is really worthwhile. Meaning, I'm prepared to die, but it's best not to die. Which I guess seems like an obvious thing to say, but remember we just read other people who actually chose death. Matityahu says, no, death is not actually valuable. Better to not die than to die. Which I guess, again, sounds trite. But in the context, actually, we can't take it as trite. It's actually a polemical point. Now, how do we see this? So really, it's a really important story for other purposes, for the history of halacha, history of Hilchot Shabbat in particular. We have a story at the end of Perek Bet in 1 Maccabees. It's really the first time in Jewish text that we ever have this question discussed and this ruling issued, that it's okay to fight a war on Shabbat. The story says that actually at first that was not the halacha. At that time, many who were seeking tzedek u'mishpat went down to the wilderness to live there. Many pursued them and overtook them. They encamped opposite them, prepared for battle against them on Shabbat. But the Jews said, "We will not come out, nor will we do what the king commands us and profane Shabbat." So the enemy quickly attacked them, but they didn't answer them, or hurl a stone at them, or block up their hiding places, because they said, "Let us all die in our innocence. Heaven and earth testify for us that you are killing us unjustly." And of course that means that they're all dead. End of story. But they'd prefer death over Chilul Shabbat. Better to die than to be Mechalel Shabbat. When Matityahu and his friends learned of it, they mourned for them deeply, and they all said to their neighbors, "Now look, if we all do that, what's the end of our fight? If we all do as our kindred has done and refuse to fight with the Gentiles for our lives, they will quickly destroy us from the earth." So they made this decision that day. "Let us fight against anyone who comes to attack us on Shabbat. Let us not all die as our kindred died in their hiding places." And of course, by the time you get to Chazal, this is halacha mekubelet. Right? This is halacha that wars can be fought on Shabbat. Offensive battles should be avoided on Shabbat. If you started, then you certainly don't have to stop. And they derive that from the pasuk in Devarim. But Matityahu is the one who paskins, says better to be mechalel Shabbat than to die. So again, it's not just that Matityahu says, you know, dying for nothing is a waste of time. Dying at all is best avoided. It's just better not to die. And if it's a choice between fighting and dying, I'm prepared to die in the fight, but I'd rather fight than die. Now what about two Maccabees though? For two Maccabees, martyrs actually play a major role in the story. And you have some of these texts. I'm not going to read them out loud, but you have them here. They're very famous stories. Two Maccabees, Perek Vav, tells the story of a certain Zakein, Elazar, who was forced physically to have Chazir in his mouth and spit it out and died. He was killed that way. And then Perek Zion tells the story of the very famous story of the woman and her seven sons, all of whom chose to martyr themselves rather than to worship Avodah Zarah and to bow down to the idol that Antiochus had set up. And then the mother herself also threw herself to death. This is not buried in Perek Aleph as it is in 1 Maccabees, But this is front, this is actually the literary core of the book. This is Perek Vav and Perek Zayin of the book. And then immediately after that, in Perek Chet, we get that the tide has turned and the Maccabim start to win. In other words, we get that that as a result of the martyrs, the Hashmonaim begin to win. So the martyrs, far from the story in 1 Maccabees, where they've, again, to use sort of harsh terminology, sort of selfishly died but not contributed to the cause, in 2 Maccabees, the martyrs are actually seen as contributing to the cause. They actually, not by beating everyone, but by inspiring everyone, martyrdom is actually valuable. That's a big difference between 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees. 1 Maccabees, martyrdom is sort of shunted to the side. It's hard to criticize them. I mean, these are martyrs for the faith, but it's also not something that that we want to recommend. It's not something that's actually valuable. In 2 Maccabees, on the other hand, martyrdom is something that's front and center. It's really central to the book, again, literarily and also conceptually. The book argues that that martyrdom actually sets the stage for that political victory. All right, I want to quickly look at two more aspects of 2 Maccabees. Okay. What time is it? Sorry.
26.
Okay. So very quickly, look at two more aspects of 2 Maccabees, and we'll conclude with this. If there are conflicts between the Jews and the Gentiles, as of course 2 Maccabees knows that there were, that was the entire story. This massive conflict between the Jews and the Gentiles, well then 2 Maccabees has to explain where this came from. Why are there conflicts? If 2 Maccabees is going to claim that the Jews and the Gentiles, everyone should be friends, and everyone gets along, everyone's good people, so why are there conflicts? And 2 Maccabees has a sort of double-barreled answer for that. First, people make mistakes. There's bad communication. There are failures of understanding. There's simple human error. If there were good communication, there's no reason that there should ever be conflicts. But unfortunately, there isn't always good communication. So we started earlier with the story of the false rumors in Yerushalayim about Antiochus' death, and then the false rumors that Antiochus heard about a revolt against him in Yerushalayim. 2 Maccabees plays that up heavily. Now, this is all, it's all a mistake. So if there's a war between the Jews and the Seleucids, it's not because the Jews and the Seleucids can't get along. They should be getting along, but unfortunately, information doesn't always travel the way it should. Ideally, though, if we would just sit down and talk, in other words, if Antiochus had come to Yerushalayim and said, okay, before I massacre you all, let me just check my sources. I heard there's a big revolt against me. Is that true? The Jews would have said, no, of course not, there's no big revolt. Oh, wow, we thought you were dead. And then it all would have been cleared up, and they would have said, oh, you know, funny mistakes on all sides, and we all would have gone home and been friends. So on the one hand, there's war only because of mistakes. On the other hand, where do these mistakes come from, and how do conflicts get sparked? Well, because there are, here and there, scattered bad apples. And this is something that's so deep-rooted in certain ways of viewing the world that you see it all the time. You see it today. If something really bad happens, it must be a bad individual here or there. The idea of the system actually being a problem, that there's actually something systemically wrong, is so troubling that you can't admit that the system is problematic. It must be that the system is fine, but that there are individuals here or there who are going in the wrong direction. So you have a lot of examples, actually, in 2 Maccabees of individual bad apples on whom we can blame pretty much everything, such as Menelaus, who's single-handedly to blame for the uprising, single-handedly to blame for provoking the tensions to begin with, and a small cast of other characters, 4 or 5 other bad apples whom one could blame for this conflict. But here's the key point here. Remember that the 2 Maccabees is written by a Jew living in the diaspora. The only alternative to blaming certain individuals and blaming mistakes is to admit that there's actually some kind of irresolvable tension between the Jews and other cultures. For 2 Maccabees, that's not possible. It cannot be that the Jews and the Seleucids or the Jews and the Hellenists can't get along. Because if it is, our entire lifestyle is thrown into question. We can't live here anymore. And our neighbors will know that, and then we'll have to leave, and our entire life has been ruptured. So our lives are fundamentally compatible. They really are. Deeply they are. If things are going wrong, So then either there's a failure of communication, a misunderstanding on one side or the other. Sometimes it's our fault. Sometimes we misunderstood. Sometimes you misunderstood. And or there's an individual here or there who's out to sabotage our peaceable relations. Now, again, lots of contemporary examples come to mind, but think also about the story in the Gemara about Churban HaBayit. It's all because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, right? It's all because of one bad guy who had one particular bad experience and then went and sabotaged the entire Jewish people through a series of events. Because what's the alternative to that? The alternative is admitting that the Jews and the Romans can't get along. And for Jews who live in the Roman Empire, that's not a happy ending. Now, on your source sheets, you have a whole story of a character named Heliodorus. I'll invite you to read that and think about it. It's the beginning of 2 Maccabees, and we now know more about that story than we did 5 years ago because of some texts that were found and published a few years ago. But I want to end with just one closing reflection. So I said at the beginning that Dr. Schiffman and Dr. Feldman have written about what actually happened. So you might come out saying now, well, how do we know what actually happened? I mean, we have two sources, both of which are interested not in telling us what actually happened, but in spinning them for particular perspectives, particular reasons. So one Maccabees wants to tell you how great the Hashmoneim were because they really had no choice. The Jews and the Gentiles just can't get along. And 2 Maccabees is interested in telling you about how everything's really just a mistake or maybe a couple of bad judgments here or there, but basically the Jews and Gentiles should be best friends forever if everyone would just talk to each other and get along nicely. So how can we really figure out what happened? So the answer is that it's not so simple. And when Dr. Schiffman writes his 4-page article on what really happened, a ton of work went into that because every step of the way, you have to weigh your sources, you have to weigh our literary sources, our archaeological sources. But here's the crux of the issue. Why is it so complicated? Because history is complicated. The story that actually happened doesn't have clear and obvious morals or lessons to take away from it. It's a complex story. It involves lots of different overlapping and interlocking tensions within Jews, among Jews, between Jews and the foreign empire, between Jews and their religion, the question of Jews' religion versus politics. Too many issues that you can easily say, and therefore it's about X. Both 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees want you to walk away saying, Hanukkah is about X. And many of us grow up with stories of Hanukkah being about X or Y or Z. But the fact is that Hanukkah is complicated. History is complicated. And certainly as adults in the diaspora, living with many of the same tensions that some of our texts are grappling with, the best way that we can do justice to them is to grapple with the complexities, sort of think through all the different overlapping issues, and to not oversimplify them and come out with simplistic moral lessons. So I'll leave you with that challenge for the rest of Hanukkah. Chag Orim Sameach. Thank you for your time.